Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs, here in Montreal, on a very windy day. Wild Trekker is a series of 50-minute podcasts. It's my writer's notebook. You will hear audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, and jam sessions with fabulous musicians. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. Today's episode of Wild Trekker is an interview I conducted several years ago with John Hare, a British explorer, author, and conservationist. John Hare has done remarkable work protecting a species of wild camel in a desert region of China. Then, in 2001-2002, he crossed the Sahara Desert from Lake Chad to Tripoli, Libya, up on the Mediterranean coast. This 1,500-mile or 2,400-kilometer journey on camel took him 3.5 months and followed a route no European had taken for a century. I met John Hare at his home in England.
Okay, so this is an interview with John Hare. Mr. Hare, could you tell me, how old is your house exactly?
Maybe I should hold it. It's just to warm up. You used to work
at the BBC, right?
What
did you do there?
For a very short time. I worked at the BBC for a very, very short time, about 15 months. I just worked, when I came back from living in Africa, I worked with the BBC Africa service.
Right. Was that a bush house then?
Yes. Yeah, producing programs for Northern Nigeria, actually, in Hausa.
Oh, okay. How old is this house here?
1490. So that goes back a bit. Not far off from when America was supposed to have been discovered.
What do you call this ceiling that you have in here? Is that a timbered ceiling?
No, that's oak. That's an oak ceiling with ribs, massive beams of oak, and I think it's amazing to think that these things have been in place for 500 years, and they're still there, and the woodworm can't get into it.
So, and what is the name of the village that we're located in right now?
We're in Benenden, which is in Kent, in the Weald of Kent. And that's quite interesting. Den, there's a lot of villages around here. There's Biddenden, Smarden, Benenden, Rolvenden. And Den means a clearing in the forest. The Weald, or this part of Kent, used to be covered in trees right up to Saxon times. And it was the Weald means the wild. Even in Elizabethan times, it was called the Wild. And then in the 18th century, 17th century, the timber was cut down, a lot of it because there's iron ore in this area. And by whatever process, they made iron. In fact, if you go to St. Paul's Cathedral in London, you'll see that the iron railings come from this part of Kent. And Den means a clearing in the forest. So going right back to medieval times, it's when the first people came and cleared spaces for agricultural purposes, and the names have carried on.
Does your farm have a name?
Yes, it's School Farm. And that's because of there's a town, a market town near here called Cranbrook, and that has a very old school, which again dates back to Elizabeth I. And this farm used to be the farm for that school. It used to produce the vegetables and keep the cattle and sheep and pigs for the school.
When I was a young man, I always looked at maps of the Canadian Arctic, especially older ones, on which were written the words Meta or Terra Incognita. And I was always straining and to imagine what it would be like to go to places which were relatively unknown. Is that something that that makes sense to you as an explorer, that you've always wanted to reach out and search out places that were relatively unknown?
Absolutely. I can remember even as a boy, under 10, being absolutely fascinated by a book called Exploration Fawcett, which was written by a man called Colonel Brown Fawcett, Percy Fawcett, who went into the Amazon, to the Mato Grosso, and certainly Terra Incognita. And I thought to myself at the time, gosh, you know, that's really what I want to do. I want to go to those sort of places. It was that book that sparked it in me. And of course, no person's life is perfect. And to lead that sort of life, you need resources and finance. And I think I've been lucky. I've managed to, in my early days, go to very remote parts through working in northern Nigeria. And latterly, through the camel, that has taken me into, certainly in parts of China, where in one or two places where I don't think people, not just foreigners, people hadn't set foot before.
Now, in your books, you mentioned several times that you're not really mechanically inclined and you're interested in the way things are naturally. Do you feel that you're trying, through your work with the camel, to retrieve something of our past that may be lost if you don't act quickly?
In a sense, yes. I feel that the world is spinning in a direction which is unnatural. I think I come back to this word natural. The natural world, the natural way of behavior is what I think is very precious and which is being lost at an incredibly fast rate for various reasons, technology being one. And I think if one can get this message to people, I know people are very receptive to this message. There are a lot of people who worry about, in the broadest sense, the way things, again in the broadest sense, are going, and they relate very much when I try to talk and mention this. there's a lot of people who are very worried. And I think the camel, the wild camel, living as it does in one of the harshest environments in the world, and has enabled me to get into that heartland. And again, at that point, and I'm only talking about in the within the last 10 years, finding a place which was pristine and unspoiled, all right, because it was in that condition because it had been used by the Chinese as a nuclear test site. But that really, to me, said yes, you know, confirmed everything I'm saying to you. Things are moving in the wrong direction. These pristine areas are so precious, terribly precious, and can teach us so much. And the people there, too, who live. I mean, it, of course, it's not just in that part of China. It's all these remote places all over the world. But they're all under pressure. Even in Lop Nor, things are changing very rapidly.
Now, when you speak of nuclear testing, are you referring to atmospheric testing? It must be underground testing at this point.
At this point, it is. But from the 1950s to 1979, there were 43 atmospheric nuclear tests. And I think over half of those were more powerful than Hiroshima.
What has motivated you to go to Xinjiang?
Xinjiang.
Xinjiang. Province? Is it a province? It's an autonomous region.
Autonomous region. Called it a province.
And into Mongolia. What have you been looking for?
What I've been looking for is the wild Bactrian or double-humped camel. Now, it wasn't until 1993, and quite by chance, I got an invitation to join a Russian expedition going to the Mongolian Gobi, that I realized that there was a wild camel. Up to that point, I didn't know there was. I'd had quite a lot of experience with camels, and I suppose at this point I ought to say I am a desert lover. I like deserts for the reasons I think I've described earlier. And camels are outside a desert. A camel looks like a rather badly designed animal. But once you travel in a desert with a camel, you realize just how wonderfully it's adapted to its environment. And here in Mongolia and in Xinjiang province in China, there is the wild Bactrian camel, a double-humped animal with a 3% base genetic difference to the domestic double-humped camel. So in other words, that is very large, actually, a large separation. And numbers were not known, and nothing was being done to protect them. And I managed, again, through a lot of good luck and fortune, to get into the Chinese area, where no foreigner had been allowed to go in there since the 1950s, and very few before then, and make expeditions to try and discover how many of these animals were left. And after making three expeditions, we were allowed by the Chinese government to put forward proposals setting up a nature reserve. And that nature reserve is as big as Poland. It's 175,000 square kilometers. And it's set up. We've got money, we've raised money, we set up a charitable foundation. And so within 10 years, we've managed to be able to set up a nature reserve.
Do you have any idea, scientifically, what is the extent of the population of these camels?
It's very difficult because in China, you can't, because there's still a military presence in part of the area, the Chinese government won't allow any aerial survey. If we were doing an aerial survey, I could be much more precise. In Mongolia, aerial surveys have been done, and we believe there's about 350 wild camels there. Our expeditions with lorries, with trucks, and with domestic camels are conversations with herdsmen who live on the fringe of the area lead us to believe that there's about 600, roughly, in the Chinese area. And what I haven't said, and what I would like to say, something that makes this animal so important is that China chose this area because there is no fresh water and therefore no people. That's why it was chosen as a nuclear test site. But the wild camel has managed to survive on totally salt water. This is most amazing point. Not only survive, but it survived these 43 atmospheric nuclear tests, which I've already mentioned. So we're dealing with an amazing animal. And at the moment, I'm not a scientist, explorer, I suppose, conservationist, but I'm certainly not a scientist. And I'm trying to interest scientists to look into, I mean, for example, is there any connection? Is there any connection between the ability to drink salt water, a very high degree of salt, which our domestic camels will not touch, and an ability to survive atmospheric nuclear tests because the animal appears to be breeding naturally? I don't know, but it's something certainly worth looking into. I also think that in this century, wars possibly will be fought over water. I think water is going to be one of the big problems that mankind is going to face in many parts of the world this century. Here we have an animal that can live on salt water. Has that got nothing to teach us? Of course it has. And so what I'm working for now is to try to interest scientists to follow on the trail from which we blazed in this area.
You mentioned the genetic difference between the wild Bactrian camel and the domesticated one. Is that right?
Yes.
Are these two species, although they are distinct, are they able to interbreed?
I must correct you there. They're not. We are not saying they're two species. We are saying that the domestic and the wild Bactrian camels have a large genetic difference. They may be two species, but we haven't reached that point yet. In fact, today, National Geographic in the States has just given a Chinese scientist who we're working very closely with a grant of money to continue his research on this DNA and genetic makeup of the wild camel. No, we're not saying it's a separate species, but 3% base difference. I believe that mankind has a 5% base difference with the chimpanzees. So 3% is enormous. It could be a separate species, but it'll take many, many, many more tests and a number of years to come to that conclusion, if that is the conclusion we'd come to.
Now, you've created a foundation to promote understanding of this wild Bactrian camel and also to attempt to preserve it.
That's right. We've set up the Wild Camel Protection Foundation. We have a website on wildcamels.com. And this is a registered charity in the United Kingdam. And there are really just two of us. There's a co-trustee called Catherine Ray, who is an environmental lawyer. And she works very closely with me and has done tremendous voluntary work to help me in many directions, because I could never do this on my own. And Catherine and I run this charity, and we've raised, through the GEF, which is part of the World Bank, the Global Environment Facility, we raised $750,000 to set up the Nature Reserve in China. And we've raised $200,000 from charitable foundations and very generous individuals. And that sounds a lot of money, but when you're setting up a nature reserve which is bigger than Poland, or, as I understand it, the size of Texas, it is not a lot of money. And when part of it has to be used for environmental awareness work, which is very important, the money soon goes. And I should mention, I think at this point, that the patron of this foundation is Jane Goodall, who many of your listeners will know of her work with chimpanzees, and latterly with an organization called Roots and Shoots, which is environmental awareness. And Jane's our patron. She's helped me also find sources of funding. And we've managed to help Jane get Roots and Shoots into China. And they're now really flourishing there and providing library packs for schools in China, which I think is a terribly worthwhile thing to do, given that years and years and years of communism have blunted the sensibilities of Chinese people to environmental damage. Now that's being rectified.
Now, if I could ask you about the Sahara, you had lived in northern Nigeria for a number of years, and you'd seen some of the last camel caravans taking off. I guess there's a few still across the desert. Had you always wanted to mount an expedition of your own?
I lived in northern Nigeria and worked actually on the northern Nigerian border with the Cameroons, which was quite a long way from the desert areas. And I had seen camel caravans, but not that many of them. What really triggered my interest in crossing the Sahara was that I'd read a book in the 1970s called Across the Sahara by a man called Hans Vischer. And he also worked in the same administrative service in northern Nigeria that I did. And he actually came back from leave in England and asked the government if he'd come back. Instead of coming back by boat, as they did in those days, and then making your way up country, he came back by camel. And the British government allowed him to do this. And he wrote a wonderful book and a very modest account of that journey. And he tried to do the return journey. And not unsurprisingly, his boss at the time said, sorry, Vischer, you can't do that return journey. If you want to go wandering about the desert, then resign from the job you're doing, but you can't be a sort of desert nomad. So he was a bit frustrated and disappointed, but he didn't make the return journey. Incidentally, he became very well known because he actually transferred to the education service and is remembered in northern Nigeria to this day for setting up a system of education which was very enlightened for its time in the 1920s when Africans were being educated, in other words, to turn black people into white people with all those values. And Vischer said, no, this is all wrong. Black people should be educated within their own culture. And he set up a system that reflected this, a system which became adopted by the British government all over the colonies as they then were. And he was knighted for this. But to get back to his frustration of not being able to cross the desert, I said I'd love to do the journey that he couldn't do. And because I was working with the camels in China, I took this as rather a sabbatical from Central Asia, and very fortunately managed to get the funds and the backing to do this journey from Lake Chad to Tripoli.
Now, how much planning is involved in something like that?
A huge amount. It took me about a year. And, of course, you're aware that Libya is not the most open of countries and has had major problems, both with the United Kingdom and with the States. And so I worked through the British ambassador, who was very, very helpful. And it took 6 months to get permission from Colonel Gaddafi to make the journey. Because remember, we were actually making the journey completely from south to north in Libya, traveling at 17 miles a day. So that took time, and the whole planning and everything took about a year.
What kind of people did you want to take on as guides?
Before we talk about guides, let's talk about the herdsmen, the people who would actually look after the camels. And I wanted to take Tuareg, and the Tuareg are nomadic people for the main part, and they live in the Sahara. And I knew that some Tuareg spoke Hausa because I also wanted to travel with people who I could communicate with all the way. And I was put in touch with a man in Agadez, which is in southern Niger, and a man called Sidi Mohamed Ilyes, and he actually found me the camels and found me the Tuaregs who could speak Hausa.
What type of camels did you take with you?
We took camels from the Ayer Mountains, the A-I-R. That's a sort of massif in central Niger. And these are known to be the best camels in the whole of the Sahara, mainly because it's very rocky and stony there. And these camels were used to traveling in very, very tough and rough conditions. It's a mistake, which is not unnaturally commonly held, that the Sahara is just one huge sheet of sand going on and on and on forever, dunes and rolling sands. But that's not the case at all. The Sahara is a number of different types of deserts, punctuated by oases, if you interpret an oasis in a place where there is water, not necessarily people, but water. And these deserts can vary, yes, from sands and dunes, but also to totally stony rock deserts, very inhospitable, in fact, more inhospitable in a sense than the sheets of sand. And so you needed camels that could cope with all those conditions, and our camels certainly could. We had these Aya camels were quite terrific.
Did you have to take all of your food with you and water?
No, but this was no, because I was hoping that the water, the wells, would still be operational. I was following a route which was one of the four great highways across the Sahara by camel before the introduction of the internal combustion engine, the motor car. And Visha was the last person that I could track down that had crossed it in its entirety from Tripoli to Lake Chad. But I didn't know. That was in 1906, and so I had no idea whether the wells that he described would be there or they were filled in with sand or whatever. So I was very concerned about that and had no way actually of discovering, as I say, whether the sands were there, whether the water was there. As for food, we lived exactly as the Tuaregs lived. Today, a staple, it wasn't when I was working in northern Nigeria, but a staple today is rice and macaroni and spaghetti, and we brought masses of that as our sort of staple diet. Then we brought, obviously, tins in Maiduguri. Maiduguri is a city near Lake Chad in northern Nigeria. We brought tinned food, but not a terrific amount, and peppers and onions and cabbages in particular, because cabbages, there they go black and slimy. If you cut them open, they stay green for a very long time. And onions are terrific survivors. You can take with them for miles and miles, and they'll still be very useful. Other vegetables like potatoes and carrots quickly shrivel up in the heat. But we also worked out where our oases were ahead of us, where there were people like Bilma or Gatrun, and where we could buy foodstuffs to re-equip. We carried water initially in goatskins, which are called salga in salgas in Hausa, because I was trying to do this journey exactly as Fisher would have done it. And then I discovered, well, a goatskin is quite a small. It doesn't hold that much. And so we compromised with the modern world by carrying our water in the inner tubes of trucks, which you cut them in half, so they're rather like a half moon shape, and then you tie them at either end, fill them with water, tie them at either end, and put one on one side of a camel and one on the other. And the poor old animal sloshes along with its two half moons of water. So that took quite a lot. But the big problem wasn't water and wasn't food. It was food for the camels, forage, grass, hay. And that we did have a serious problem. It ran out at one point, mainly because nobody could tell me accurately how much we should take, and we underestimated. And were incredibly lucky, actually, because it's heart-rending to have a team or caravan of camels who work hard for you all day, and then you find yourself totally unable to feed them in the evening when you camp because there's absolutely no vegetation at all and your grass has run out. And I managed to, by the greatest good fortune, we discovered a place where a caravan coming in the opposite direction had camped, and they'd obviously had a lot of grass, and they'd left it over, left some over. And so we were able to feed our camels on that. And that happened for the next 3 days, and we got out of this very difficult situation.
Could you show me on this map where you went?
Yes, of course. There's Lake Chad, and as you can see, we followed the road up to Bilma in central Niger. And then there is a very difficult bit up to the Niger border, where we came to a place called Tumo, T-U-M-M-O. And then just beyond that border was this place that I'm just been talking about, where we had all this trouble with the forage for the camels. We got through that, got to Tajiri, and then to Gatrun. Now, Gatrun links with the motor road. So that was really the first time that we came to the link of a motor road. That was Christmas time, and enterprising Catherine Ray had managed to send us a Christmas hamper from the well-known London shop called Fortnum & Mason. And it was full of wonderful goodies, which, having eaten our goat and macaroni and blackened cabbages for weeks, what a treat it was to get tinned mince pies. And but for security, the Libyans had taken the bangers out of the crackers so they wouldn't bang. And of course, being a non-alcoholic country, there was no alcohol except for the brandy butter. But that was a great treat. And then we went on from Gatrun to Murzuk. Murzuk being a very important town during the camel days, but now not important at all. And I think this brings me on to one other point. This road was used notoriously during the 19th and earlier centuries as a slave route. It was where the Arabs used to come down and catch slaves in what is now northern Nigeria. And if the farmers there had had a bad harvest, if the rains had failed, they used to go out and raid their neighbours and catch them, so that when the Arabs came down, there was a sort of catchment of slaves waiting to be taken back. And these poor wretched people had to go on foot, and women and children died. And the early explorers' accounts on this same road that we took of the bones that they came across is heartrending. And commercially, it's a horrible statistic, but it's true that if they got 20% of their cargo to Murzuk, where the slave market was, then they made a profit. So in other words, you could afford to lose 80%. And then from Murzuk, we went to Tekatiba. And Tekatiba takes you onward from there, some incredible sand dunes, which have lakes at the foot of them, 13 about lakes. And these are amazing, totally uninhabited now. Colonel Gaddafi has cleared out the inhabitants mainly for security reasons. And then we went on through this area to Wunzirik. Again, these towns are not important now, but 100 years ago, and for many hundreds of years before that, they were very important staging posts on this north-south route across the Sahara. And then we got to what Visscher called the worst desert in the Sahara, the Hamada El Homra. And that's 180 miles long and 360 miles wide. It's a plateau, totally, totally horizonless. You can't see anything. There's no features at all. And by this time, it's very cold in the winter, and the wind howls across down from the Mediterranean. And it's 7 days crossing. But unfortunately, our guide got lost and turned it into 9 days crossing, which was more difficult for us. And eventually, you come out of that to the Tobonia Valley and well. And then we got to Mizda, And we stopped at Misda. Misda is within the Tripoli metropolitan area, so I felt we'd really got to Tripoli. But nowadays, unlike in Vicious Day, there are total suburbia and suburbs and roads stretching down to Misda, and it would have been virtually impossible to follow the route beyond Misda. And also, you wouldn't have been allowed to take camels into Tripoli, and they'd have spooked at all the traffic and everything. So I felt we'd done our journey by finishing at Misda, not exactly at Tripoli itself. So that's the route.
Okay. Now, how does it feel to be taking part or leading an expedition across the Sahara? Do you gradually become detached from what you knew before? Do you find peace? Do you find a renewed understanding of things?
Can we stop? Can I get a glass of water?
Sure.
Other way, because I've been talking quite a bit.
So the question was, when you are leading an expedition across the Sahara, what happens in your mind?
In your mind? Well, I mean, I think remember, the expedition is with camels. And what's in your mind is that you can't really achieve more than about 25 miles a day. That's the upper limit. And depending on the terrain, you might even do 15, 14 miles a day. So in your mind, you get into a mindset that amount of mileage is the natural, and I come back to that word again, the natural speed which you can travel. And remember, that was the speed that our forebears before about 1900 traveled since the dawn of time. And this, again, talking about what we've lost in the world today, one of the things I feel is this rush and urge for speed and hurry is unnatural. So that's one thing that's in your mind. Obviously, it varies from where you are. If we pass through one area which was quite dangerous because there was political trouble amongst a tribe called the Tubu, who were agitating for independence, or are agitating, I should say. So that was uppermost in my mind during that part, to keep out of trouble. Then your camel's welfare is uppermost in your mind. Are they healthy? Have you got enough food for them? And you're thinking about... I think the way I did it, actually, was to never project myself forward beyond the next oasis. Now, that's the way I did it. Other people might say that was short-sighted and you should be thinking about all the problems weeks ahead of you. But no, the next oasis, which might take 8 or 9 days to reach across dunes or whatever. So my target was to get, shall we say, to Bilma. And once I got to Bilma, my target was the oasis, Yat, which is beyond Bilma. And that's how I managed to cope with it. And when I got to Yat, I'd project my mind forward to the next target place. One of the difficulties is actually when the wind became very strong and I couldn't talk to my companions, and they couldn't talk to me, unless we shouted at each other, was actually to come to terms with the fact of sitting on an animal and not being able to talk for about 8 or 9 hours a day. And that's, that. You know, after this whole journey took me 3.5 months. So after a few days, that becomes quite a problem, actually. And I counted it by singing all the songs I knew and then singing all the hymns I knew and repeating all the poems I knew, because I tried to read a book and found that impossible because of the swaying motion of the camel. So... that was another thing that was difficult or on one's mind.
Did you ever feel uncertainty or despair about being able to continue to make it to the destination?
Not really, no. Well, there is an element of uncertainty there, but despair is not a word I would use. Nor if I think anybody who does this sort of thing, you have to have. I mean, I have an instinctive confidence that I'll get there, or alternatively, get out of. I mean, once in China, our camels ran off and left us stranded on the edge of Lop Nor, the lake. I always felt we would get through it, we'd get out of it somehow. Now, some people could say that that's, you know, being foolish, but it's the way that I am able to cope with situations, this sort of self-belief that one will get out of it and get there in the end.
What is left of Lake Chad today? What does it look like? Is it infested with malaria-bearing mosquitoes? Is it a swamp? I mean, what's left of Lake Chad today?
I didn't actually see it. And the reason I didn't see it was because it shrunk so much. And to go and see it would have taken us off our route. When Vischer did the journey in 1906, he passed along the lakeside. Now that lakeside has shrunk by about 15 to 20 miles. And I hadn't got the time, as I told you, a day's journey is 15 or 20 miles. And I hadn't got the time to make detour to go and see Lake Chad. As I understand it, Lake Chad isn't very deep, and it never has been. It used to be it used to be a lot of very small sort of islands, which were surrounded by this great sheet of water, but not deep. And there used to be people who lived on the islands. I think they're called the Bulmenia, or Bulmenia. And historically Lake Chad has always shrunk and increased its size. But I think what man has done in the last 40 years is to pump water out for farms on the fringe of the lake. And because the level is so small, I mean, we're talking about 10 feet or something, it'll go down very rapidly. So irrigation has not been a sensible project. Of course, why irrigate? Well, of course, because the population has increased. And another one of the things I believe is that most of the problems in our world, and you can, any part of the world, are caused by population, size of population. And here, Chad's shrinkage has been caused by the expansion of the population.
I've been 4 times to the Sahara Desert, in Mauritania, Mali, and Morocco. In an oasis of the Adrar region of Mauritania, I remember encountering a Moor, that is, an Arabic-speaking owner of a herd of camels and goats, who allowed me to record the singing and drumming of several Haratin women. The Haratin are black Africans, who have historically been held in slavery by the Arab population of Mauritania. This evening of song with the Haratin women reminds me that the Sahara is not just a great ocean of sand dunes and desolation. It is a world apart, where desert peoples preserve their own customs and rituals from thousands of years ago. This is true of the white Moors of Mauritania, as well as of the Tuareg I've encountered in the Sahel of Mali and Nigeria. Hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, my film, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net. And Evidencia is spelt the way it is in Latin, E-V-I-D-E-N, as in normal, T-I-A, Evidencia. The opening theme at the beginning of each Wild Trekker podcast is sung by Marie Frenette, with me accompanying her on the piano. The piece you are listening to right now is one of my compositions evoking a camel caravan as it crosses the Sahara Desert. That's me on the piano and Cameron Wallace on the clarinet and saxophone. How does Cameron play two instruments at the same time, you ask? Well, we recorded several tracks, then mixed them. Now here's Marie Frenette, singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Desmeules on the guitar. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2020, George Toombs. All rights reserved. Let's get together soon.